Hello, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Heather Lee, and I am a member of the Society's National Development Team based out of Denver, Colorado, and I'm delighted to welcome each of you to today's research call. As valued friends and supporters, we are eager to have you join what should be an engaging and exciting discussion with the Society's Senior Research Leadership Team today. This team includes our Chief Research Officer, Dr. Timothy Kutze, our Associate Vice President of Discovery Research, Dr. Bruce Bebo, and our Vice President of Healthcare Delivery and Policy Outreach, Dr. Nicholas LaRocca. But before we begin with today's discussion, I'm pleased to announce that we're also joined by the Society's Chief Executive Officer today, Cindy Zaghi-Boilo. Thanks for joining us, Cindy. So I know that Cindy would like to say a few words to each of you before we hand things over to the research team. So Cindy, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. Thank you, Heather, and thank you everyone for being on the call today. I was very pleased to see some of the names on the call today, people who dialed in that I know. I understand Mike is on, Mike from Greater Delaware Valley from Philadelphia, and John from Virginia. I look forward to seeing you at the meetings that we have in May. And I see that Mona is on, so I look forward I'm glad you're on the call today, too. And I heard Laura Wyden is on the call today. And I know I've been writing you notes regularly, and so it's wonderful that you were able to join the call today. And there's several others of you that I've seen recently that I'm so glad you joined. There's a lot going on in MS research and news these days, and so why don't we go right ahead and get started. And so, Tim, why don't you go ahead and tell us the latest news in MS.
Well, thank you, Cindy, and thank you, everybody, for joining us for this call. It is exciting to always share breaking news in the world of research, and one of the exciting things is that yesterday the FDA approved the 10th disease-modifying therapy for relapsing forms of MS. It's our third pill. It's a drug called Tecfidera. Formerly, you might have heard of this in the news, referred to as BG12. But now, you know, as things happen when drugs get approved, they get a name that none of us would ever recognize and have a hard time saying. So this is, it's called Tecfidera, T-E-C-F-I-D-E-R-A, and we have lots of information on the Society website about it. What's exciting about this new therapy is that obviously it's important to add more new treatments to treating relapsing MS because, you know, sometimes some people have a hard time tolerating some of the existing therapies, and so having more treatment options it's certainly better. It's exciting because its mode of delivery is something that many people with MS have been asking for. It's a capsule form that basically you take twice a day. And it was really very encouraging to see this approved. It is being marketed by Biogen IDEC, who are the people that also make Avonex and Tysabri. And so they, you know, it's another tool in the company's toolbox in terms of a treatment for MS. You know, one of the reasons why clinicians are excited about this, besides the fact that it's a twice-a-day capsule, it showed, very significant improvement in the clinical trials that led up to the approval by the FDA. You know, they one of the data points that get used in clinical trials is, you know, what are the number of people that have a relapse when they're on the therapy versus people who are taking something else. And so, in the clinical trial, they found that, you know, there was a 49% reduction in the number of people having a relapse in if they were taking Tecfidera versus a placebo, and the same was true in the measure of, you know, how quickly do people progress in getting disability. If people are on Tecfidera, they had a slower progression to disability compared to the placebo, and so this was really important and exciting findings in terms of how this therapy works. And so it's really, I think, a good news for people with MS, especially if they're newly diagnosed or have relapsing forms of the disease, that this new treatment option is available. It does have some potential risks. The most common adverse event, as we call it, is that individuals can have what's called flushing when they start taking the therapy, which is, you know, a sensation of heat or itching or perhaps a red blushing of their skin. And then also they have some, people can have gastrointestinal problems, some diarrhea, some nausea, but most of those seem to resolve themselves afterwards. So, you know, on balance, it looks to be a very safe and, based on the clinical trials, effective therapy. So this is good news. At this point, as of today, we don't know things such as, you know, what is the price going to be or how quickly will the drug be available in the pharmacy. Our experience has been is that, you know, with these things, it's generally very rapid, at least in terms of its availability to people. What its price point will be is one of those questions that I've been asked by several people already. What's it going to cost? And at this point, I have to tell you, we don't know, but we hope to know soon so that we can certainly provide and share that information for people with MS. Now, I think one of the important things for us to keep in mind as we think about this good news and in what has really been an explosion, at least in neurological disease, of the number of treatments for MS. Relapsing remitting, you know, we went from having nothing in 1992 to now having our 10th disease-modifying treatment for relapsing forms of MS. But one of the important questions that we get asked is, well, this is great for relapsing. What about progressive MS? You know, there's no treatments approved for progressive forms of the disease. And so, you know, what are we doing to tackle that as a national MS society? You know, a couple things to keep in mind as we think about the progressive aspects of the disease is that, you know, all of the disease-modifying therapies that have been previously approved, not Tecfidera, obviously, have been tested in progressive forms of MS and haven't been successful. That's probably because, as we understand it, progressive MS is probably a different form of a disease, and so the treatments may not be for relapsing may not be as applicable for progressive forms of MS. And so there's that component of it. There's also, you know, we from a biology point of view still need to learn a lot about what differentiates progressive MS from relapsing remitting MS. And that type of questions and some of the other questions around, you know, how do we treat, how do we enhance quality of life for people with MS, are all areas in progressive MS research that need attention. And so to tackle that, the National MS Society, in partnership with our societies in Canada, the United Kingdom, Italy, the Dutch MS Society, as well as the MS International Federation, have all come together to form an umbrella kind of collaboration amongst all of us called the International Progressive MS Collaborative. And what the collaborative is at its simplest description is a shared commitment by the leading MS societies that invest in MS research around the world to pool their knowledge and their resources to tackle some of the toughest aspects of progressive MS. And so, you know, rather than trying to do it all on our own and working in silos, the staff leadership and the volunteer leaders have come together to say, people with MS, progressive MS, want to see the same progress that we've seen for relapsing MS. And so, how do we do this together? How do we do things faster? So we banded together. We published a white paper identifying what are the key areas of research that we need to focus on, and these include things such as getting the tools for research purposes, such as developing better models for understanding MS in the progressive MS in the laboratory, so that we can try to develop those treatments. To look at repurposing of existing therapies for MS, so that we can bring over perhaps something that's already been approved for another disease and apply it to progressive MS. And to do that, you need tools to do the drug screening and the sort of the biological analysis in the laboratory. But beyond that, though, you know, we also were, when we looked hard at the issue, said, you know, we need to figure out how to do clinical trials better and faster. that the tools physicians use to measure progression may not be suitable for clinical trials today. And so we need to come up with new and better tools that can both measure progression and that also are accepted by the regulatory authorities, the FDA in the United States, the EMA in Europe, and in other countries. Because, you know, if the regulators don't accept how you're measuring something in clinical trials, it doesn't matter whether or not, you know, they need to be confident that what is being tested actually shows a benefit in people with MS. So having the regulators and governments involved is critical. And then the last piece, the last area of focus was addressing the quality of life for people who live with progressive MS. You know, addressing things such as symptom management, rehabilitation, exercise therapy. You know, we have a conviction as a collaborative that, you know, it is critical that we both look at the early science, understanding what is contributing and causing progression, while at the same time making sure that our efforts are also put underway so that people who live with progressive MS, you know, can have tools such as exercise, rehab, symptom management to improve the quality of life while we're trying to find and discover those important disease-modifying therapies. And so we have to do these things simultaneously, not linearly, because people with living with progressive MS today need us to bring the tools for them to have an improved quality of life. And so, you know, with any effort like this, you know, we're bringing people together. And, you know, one of the things we do is we bring the scientists together. And so we brought something, you know, 175 of the world's leaders in progressive MS to a meeting that was held at the San Rafael Institute in Milan, Italy, a leading MS center in Italy. And, you know, at the meeting we talked about all of these issues and really identified priority areas that, now what we're doing is the scientific community has spoken and said, you know, you need to focus on these three areas. And so what the collaborative is doing next is distilling those down, figuring out what may be happening in other areas so that we don't duplicate effort, and then jumping in and saying, okay, let's figure out how we fund research in these areas in a global and collaborative manner. We're just at the earliest stages. But what I will share with you is that while we're just beginning, the passion that was expressed at this meeting by the scientists as well as the patient advocates, we had people who live with MS at this conference sharing their perspective with the scientists about what it is to live with progressive MS. You know, there is a shared purpose and a shared commitment by the scientific community, regardless of where they are on the spectrum, whether they work on animal models or work on exercise and rehab, there is a shared goal of working together to really begin to address these issues. To say, you know, it's bedrock is that we've made so much progress in relapsing remitting MS. Now, how do we achieve that for progressive MS? And so, we're very excited about what this represents for the future. It's something that we are committed to supporting as a National MS Society, and you know, something that you'll be hearing more about in the months and years ahead. If you want more information on the Society website, there's a synopsis of the meeting that you can download that gives you some of the scientific highlights in more detail. We'll be sharing more information about this as we go forward. So that's sort of the highlights of the exciting news that happened yesterday with BG12, highlights of what's happening internationally in the world of progressive MS. And now for what I'd like to do is introduce you to a couple of important team members of the research team at the National MS Society. You know, anytime you have an organization like ours that this year, you know, we'll spend close to $47 million on research and, you know, look at, you know, over 500 proposals. It's important to have staff leadership who are able to drive and work with the scientific community and all the volunteers who you know, scientific volunteers who give us their time to help us assess the science, but also to work with the staff team to be able to make sure that we're managing our science and managing our priorities in a disciplined and focused manner. And so I'm really delighted to introduce a couple key members of the team who really make the research programs run at the MS Society, Bruce Bebo and Dr. Nick LaRocca. And so Dr. Bebo is our Associate Vice President of Discovery Research. Bruce comes to us having been both an MS Society-funded researcher. He was an MS Society fellow, having trained with Dr. Dennis Bourdet, and then he went off and did some work in the pharmaceutical industry and then worked at another nonprofit. And we were very fortunate about a year ago that Bruce joined us at the team here at the Society. And so, Bruce, I'm going to turn it over to you. But before you tell us some of the some of the project highlights that came out of the most recent RPAC meeting, perhaps you could share with the with our listeners, what exactly does the Associate Vice President of Discovery Research do?
thanks, Tim, and it's great to be on the call. I'm happy to join you and describe a little bit about what I do. So. It's a complicated title, but in essence, my job's to basically help the society make smart investments in biomedical research. And the biomedical research could be defined as research in culture or in animals or even in humans that's aimed at understanding the basic essence of MS and developing strategies for stopping MS in its tracks. So I'm proud to be part of the society and honored to serve in this capacity.
Excellent, thank you. Well, I know one of your areas of responsibility is to work with other members of the scientific team to oversee the activities of several peer review committees that review proposals that come in each year. And those peer review committees, scientists make their recommendations about what they think is the highest quality or meritorious science, as we call it, and then those get put forward to a group of our senior scientific advisors who work on the research programs advisory committee. And just for everyone to know, we have over 100 scientific advisors who give us their time. And so the Research Programs Advisory Committee, the RPAC, meets twice a year to look at all of the work that come out of the review committees. The RPAC just met in January, Bruce, and I know we looked at a lot of interesting science, and I know it's a bit like when people ask me which one of my children I love most, but I'm going to ask you, which one of the 100 or so projects that we ended up looking at the RPAC, could you give us a few highlights of which are the ones that excite you? Recognizing they're all exciting, but which ones really excited you?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. So if I recall correctly, I believe we reviewed from research grants about 150 grants last cycle, and out of those grants, we recommended, I believe, in the end, about 22 or so grants that were recommended. Considered meritorious, and you're right, it's hard to differentiate between any of them. They're all excellent science. A few of them sort of rose to the top for me for today's discussion. The first one I wanted to share with the group was a research grant that was awarded to Emmanuel Wabant, who's at the University of California, San Francisco, and the title of the grant is Microbiomes in Pediatric MS. And so Dr. Wabant, she's the director of the Pediatric MS Center of Excellence at UCSF, and this is one of five centers of excellence in pediatric MS that were originally made possible starting, I believe, in 2006 by funding from the Society. And the primary mission of this network, this Pediatric MS Network, is to improve the diagnosis and care of children with MS. However, the centers were also tasked with collecting data on pediatric MS cases so that we could do large-scale research initiatives. And so this is exactly what Dr. Wabant has done with her center at UCSF. So she recently submitted and received a large grant, I believe it's around a $3 million grant from the NIH to investigate environmental, and environmental in this case, and for this purposes of the grant, is primarily infectious agents such as Epstein-Barr virus and environmental factors and genetic risk factors that might potentially trigger pediatric MS. And so the grant from the NIH and the infrastructure that it provides is an amazing resource that we are leveraging with this grant, this research grant, to study additional risk factors for pediatric MS. So in a nutshell, what she proposes is to examine the gut microbiome in pediatric MS. So what is the microbiome? So the microbiome is the totality of all the microbes, their genes, and the interactions between these microbes and their genes and a particular environment. So in this case, the environment is the gastrointestinal system. She proposes and is funded now to examine the gut microbiome in pediatric MS. And so just to put that in context, I mean, in recent years, the gut microbiome has been shown to shape the maturation of the immune response early in life. And this shaping could have a role in determining a person's susceptibility to MS. So the rate of birth by cesarean section and diet and breastfeeding, for example, have substantially changed in the last few decades. And it's unclear whether these changes have contributed to the rise and the increase in MS. So there's some evidence that the gut microbiome can influence MS-like disease in mice, so that's additional evidence that there may be a role to play in MS. So the question the grant's trying to answer is, does the gut microbiome play a role in susceptibility to MS? And studying a pediatric population has a number of advantages in trying to answer this question. A pediatric MS provides a really interesting and unique window of opportunity to study risk factors, mainly because they are closer to the time of exposure to these risk factors. So in this study, Dr. Wabath and her team are planning to evaluate a subgroup of 100 children from the larger study that includes 640 children with MS and 1,280 matched controls that are being studied in the NIH project. So she's taking 100 of these children and essentially looking at the gut microbiome by collecting feces from these individuals and sequencing all of the genes from the bacteria that they find. And they're also going to be collecting saliva samples from the nasal cavities and blood that they're going to store for comparisons to the bacteria that they isolate from the gastrointestinal tract. So the overarching goal for the grant was to advance our understanding of how the human microbiome is associated with MS. And long-term, this research and research like this could help us develop new strategies that I think could potentially end MS, identifying triggering factors, microbiome factors that increase a person's risk of developing MS or susceptibility, and being able to intervene could potentially prevent MS from starting in the first place. So that's why I was excited about Emmanuel's grant.
So let me ask you about that grant a little bit more, Bruce. So would it be fair to say that it sounds like, you know, this is a grant that's built on, you know, a rather large collaboration of several groups working together. I mean, if Emmanuel were trying to do this on her own, do you think she'd be able to pull it off, or is this really hinge on that collaboration that the Society facilitated?
No, I mean, clearly the seed for all of this was the grants to establish the Pediatric Centers of Excellence that, you know, was made now, 8 years ago or so. You know, that really is the beginning of all of this. And then, you know, I think it's very clear that, you know, this particular grant is leveraging a large investment made by the NIH that, you know, wouldn't have been possible without our initial investment, I don't believe. And there are, you know, in order to recruit this large number of patients, there'll be, recruiting patients from a dozen or more sites around the country. So it does require a great deal of collaboration to pull off a project such as this one.
Excellent. Thank you. So is there another project in this group that excited you?
Yeah, there are a couple more. The next one I'd like to share with the group was a research grant. This one's really cool. This one was awarded to a person. Her name is Kristen von Lie. I believe I'm pronouncing it right. She's from MIT, and she's not. This grant stands out for me for several reasons. I mean, she's not a neurologist or an immunologist or cell biologist. Dr. Van Lie is a material science engineer, and the title of her grant is, "Do the mechanical properties of MS lesions influence the extent of remyelination?" So this really, really innovative proposal. She's proposing to approach the problem of remyelination failure in a completely different way than anyone else I've seen so far. She's assembled a multidisciplinary team of experts that are engineers and material scientists, but also glial cell biologists and neuroscientists to examine the problem of remyelination failure. So let me just explain that a little bit. So I believe most of us are on the call are familiar with the idea that the myelin sheaths are these like biological tubes that surround nerve fibers in the brain and the spinal cord, and they serve to protect the neurons and the nerve cell axons, the electric wiring in the central nervous system, and allow them to conduct the electrical impulses efficiently. And the myelin sheaths are made by cells called oligodendrocytes. I believe you're probably all familiar with that as well. And in MS, the immune system attacks and kills these oligodendrocytes. It removes the myelin sheaths or damages them from the nerve fibers, and it makes them less efficient in conducting electrical signals, but it also leaves them very vulnerable to injury. And in young people, these new oligodendrocytes are readily generated from stem cells that are found in different areas of the central nervous system. These stem cells are called oligodendrocyte progenitor cells, and that's kind of a mouthful, so it's easier to just call them OPTs. So these are precursors to the cells that make myelin. And they're recruited to the sites of damage in the brain and the spinal cord. And following the loss of the oligodendrocytes, these OPCs become activated, and they move into the areas of damage, and they make copies of themselves or proliferate, and then they differentiate or they turn themselves into mature myelin-forming oligodendrocytes. And that whole process is referred to as remyelination. And like all regenerative processes, remyelination gets less efficient as we get older. And this phenomenon is really important, obviously, in a disease like MS, which is often lasts for many decades. So this means that a person that has MS, as it progresses, the likelihood of remyelination occurring gets lower, it decreases. And the likelihood that nerve fibers that are insulated by these oligodendrocytes are damaged. And this may be the sort of basis for progressive disease. So for this reason, there's an urgent need to devise therapies that promote remyelination and therapies that protect nerve fibers. And there's a lot of research, and we're funding a lot of research in this area. But this is just a really interesting novel approach. So, developing these therapies are going to require a detailed knowledge of how remyelination works and why it fails. And we've learned a lot over the last few years about how conventional techniques of biologists and medical researchers can address this problem. However, it may very well be that there are other factors that influence how cells function better, and that these functions might be better understood by physicists and engineers. And this could potentially open up a whole new area of knowledge and insight. So this investigator from MIT has formed, as I said, this consortium of biologists and physicists that are going to understand how the mechanical features of the nervous system influence the process of remyelination. So they've already shown in their preliminary data that these OPCs, again, the cells responsible for remyelination, are sensitive to mechanical signals. So specifically, they found that migration and proliferation and differentiation are affected by changes to the actual physical stiffness of the environment that they're cultured in. So they've also determined that the central nervous system becomes less stiff in an experimental model of MS in mice. And they hypothesized that this change in physical stiffness of the tissue, the central nervous system tissue, might be a barrier to remyelination. So in this grant, they're going to investigate how these signals regulate the function of these oligodendrocyte precursor cells, and whether this explains the decline in remyelination efficiency that occurs with aging. And there, I hope no one's going to ask me any questions about the techniques, because they're using a microscope called an atomic force microscope that uses nano indentation for probing mechanical properties of live cells. And I'm not quite sure how that works, but it sounds pretty cool. So this study has, I think, the potential to open up really radical new ways of enhancing remyelination and stopping progression and restoring function in MS.
Oh, excellent. Well, I mean, I think, you know, in these just these two examples, I think that you've shared, Bruce, you've illustrated for our listeners the sort of the breadth of the society's sort of holistic approach to MS research, where on the one hand you have, you know, Dr. Wabant looking at, you know, microbes and pediatric MS and large clinical collaborative centers, all the way over to, you know, what is clearly a new area, a new frontier, you know, the physical properties of the brain and how those might be able to influence remyelination and, you know, really bringing in, you know, new people to the field, bringing engineers. I think this might actually be only the first or the second grant we've ever given to MIT, and so bringing new people into the field is a terrific thing. So,